together, and it is 1:32, and I'm Senator Dennis Egan sitting in for Chair Betty Davis, who is unavailable for this meeting. At the meeting, Senator Fred Dyson, Senator Kevin Meyer, Senator Johnny Ellis, and Senator Kathy Geisel is not a member of the committee, but I've invited her to sit at the table. So we have two pieces of legislation on the agenda for today. Senate Bill 12, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Nursing. And then after that, House Bill 16, an act extending senior benefit program. And it already passed the House, so instead of Senate Bill 21, we'll be taking up House Bill 16. And to speak to Senate Bill 12, Celeste Hodge from Senator Davis's office.
Members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Celeste Hodge. I am staff to Senator Betty Davis. The bill before you, Senate Bill 12, extends the Board of Nursing termination date 8 years to June 30th, 2019, as recommended by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee in December 2010. The mission of the Alaska Board of Nursing is to actively promote and protect the health of the citizens of Alaska through the safe and effective practice of nursing as defined by law. The board makes final licensing decisions and takes disciplinary action against people who violate the licensing laws. The Board of Nursing plays an important role in public health and safety. Committee members, that's my introduction of this simple bill. We do have Nancy Sanders, Executive Administrator of the Alaska Board of Nursing, online to provide testimony and answer questions about the board, and Pat Davidson with Legislative Budget and Audit, as well as Ron Crayer, Acting Director with the Division of Public Assistance, available to answer questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hodge. Is there anyone in the audience that has signed up to testify? Do we know? I don't think so. And there are, as you heard, other individuals available to answer questions from the committee. Questions of the committee?
Yeah, if there's somebody here from the board, I'd enjoy asking a couple of questions.
I do believe we have, through the chair, online, as I shared, the administrator, executive administrator online to answer questions of the board.
Are you online, Mr. Administrator or Ms. Administrator? Is there anyone online?
Sorry. Members of the committee, this is Nancy Sanders.
Thank you, Nancy.
I'm the Executive Administrator for the Board of Nursing.
Yeah, Nancy, thanks for what you do. This Senator Dyson, Eagle River. One of the things I'm always concerned about, particularly with boards having to do with ethical practice in the medical field, do you all deal with many licensing censure issues?
Yes, Senator Dyson, if there is a complaint from the public or from another licensee, we take those very seriously. They're investigated by the investigative unit, and depending on whether they're founded, the Board of Nursing acts to discipline the person's license. So many is relative. As far as ethical complaints, I would say not many.
Yeah, I probably misused the terms, but really having to do with poor medical practice. So last 5 years, how many complaints have you generally heard per year, and how many of them, and what percentage of those have resulted in disciplinary actions?
Senator Dyson, I don't have those specific numbers at my desk here.
But just in general, give me an idea how many a year and the percentage that result in actions. 10, 50, 100?
Nancy, are you still online?
Push the mute button.
I didn't push it, but
okay.
Still here. What I was saying is, you know, the board acts on several different types of complaints. Some of them are related to continued competency audits. Some are related to the licensee not putting down some key information on their application. And then others for what we call unprofessional conduct, and we have regulations relating to those. So if there is a violation of unprofessional conduct regulations, then the person would be disciplined.
Yeah, and please, thank you for letting me continue, Mr. Chairman. What I'm concerned about is unprofessional conduct that affects patients. And do you see many of those?
I would say, I wouldn't say they're the majority, but yes, we do see those probably at every meeting, their quarterly board meeting. I would say maybe 5 to 8 per meeting.
Yeah, so 20 to 30 per year. I would enjoy, when you have time, just run down the statistics for the last 4 or 5 years on the number of the complaints and how many result in actions for unprofessional conduct that would affect client patients.
And investigations would have the number of complaints. I would only know the number that resulted in actions, but I could get those figures for you.
Yeah, no hurry, and it certainly won't affect what we're doing here today. Which groups of nurses have prescriptive authority? Nurse practitioners do, and I think, and who else?
Nurse practitioners include nurse practitioners and certified nurse midwives, and the other category is CRNAs, which are nurse anesthetists, certified nurse anesthetists.
Okay, good.
Those groups, yes.
Yeah, and are professional nurses, licensed nurses in our state ever under any pressure to not report unprofessional conduct that affects patients?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right. Thanks for what you do and for the group.
Thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Sanders from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for testifying, Nancy. And that completes the off-net testimony on this piece of legislation. Do I hear a motion? Senator Dyson.
Respectfully, it's generally a courtesy to hear from our auditor who audits these things.
Ms. Davidson, would you come forward, please? I'll figure it out. Don't worry.
No, you're doing good.
And she told me she was going to testify as well.
For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. We did perform a sunset review of the Board of Nursing. The objective of that audit was to determine if the termination date of the board should be extended. Based on our review, we recommended that the board be extended until June 30, 2019, which is an 8-year extension. We also had 4 recommendations in this report. The first was that the Board of Nursing should take action to ensure that the appropriate entities are notified when an advanced nurse practitioner's authority to write prescriptions has been revoked or suspended. In one instance, a prescriptive authority was revoked and the nurse continued to write and have prescriptions filled. The Board of Nursing had not yet established an effective notification process to prevent the filling of unauthorized prescriptions. Secondly, we believe that the Board of Nursing needs to improve its oversight of the Certified Nurses Aid Training Program. On-site reviews are being done sporadically, and there's no process or evaluation of the self-evaluation forms that are being submitted biannually for the Certified Nurses Aid Training Programs. Our third recommendation was that the individual appointed to the licensed practical nurse position on the board does not currently meet statutory qualifications. According to the statute, that board position is to be held by an LPN working in the institutional nursing situation, and the board member who was on the board during the review, which would have been the last summer, was an LPN working as an emergency medical technician. Our fourth recommendation was actually addressed to the Division of Corporate Professional and Business Licenses, and that was that they needed to do more timely investigation of complaints made to individuals licensed under the board.
Thank you, Ms. Davidson. I apologize for forgetting you. Questions for Ms. Davidson? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. If Nancy, are you still there? That's the gal.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I assume you have seen these recommendations from the auditor. Is that true?
Yes.
And do you contest them, or you have a plan and action to rectify the things that have come to light?
We have seen them. We don't disagree. We were aware of all of the concerns. We have taken steps to address several of them. The last one is, of course, at the division level. But would you like me to address each one?
I would. Yes, please.
Okay. Recommendation one was to take steps to ensure appropriate entities were notified if the board took action to revoke or suspend a nurse practitioner's authority to write prescriptions. The board has instituted policies to notify the DEA, federal DEA, on the first day after the board meeting concludes about the action. We're submitting those names to the Board of Pharmacy to let them know about the suspension or revocation. If there is an employer, as many ANPs are in private practice themselves, but if there is an employer, to let them know and to update the disciplinary database on our website within 2 weeks. So that is the plan. I might also add at this time that this is a very rare occurrence. In the time that I've been executive administrator for 4 years, this has happened 3 times. So it is a rare occurrence, but a serious one, as was pointed out. Recommendation two, the division is aware that as far as the CNA training program reviews, this is actually it's a federal mandate that is also in our regulations. There has been an issue with personnel that that position was not filled, so the personnel issues, the PCN number was reused. Director Habiger is seriously looking at this issue and trying to determine if there is personnel money to be able to hire somebody. The current person is on a 2-year contract, so I would say about 85% of the CNA programs have been recently reviewed and reapproved or not by the Board of Nursing. That contract goes until the end of June. As far as the LPN, I understand I've been trying to be reached by the Governor Parnell's office because the current LPN, her term on the board expires the end of this month, and it looks like a new person has been appointed to the board in the LPN position. So that is being taken care of.
Thank you.
Further questions for either Ms. Sanders or Ms. Davidson? Those are the only, Senator Dyson.
Well, thanks, Pat. And I've known this lady for a long time. And if you think you're going to fool her on anything, you got to get up real early in the day. And I'm always impressed with the thoroughness that they do on their job. And we appreciate it. And I'd like to say something to board there, to committee. The Board of Pharmacy has been working on having a statewide drug registry so that anybody going to get a prescription filled, it'll show up and the pharmacist can quickly see if that person is abusing the system or doc shopping or reproducing the prescriptions, you know, to get them filled in many places. That's far beyond what we all hoped it would be in implementation, but the abuse of prescription drugs is profound in our state. OxyContin selling for $85 a capsule in Anchorage, and you probably know that in your hometown here, Mr. Chairman, they just
had a major
$95,000 bust. That folks have figured out how to, they cook it just like cocaine and sniff it or shoot it. And it has apparently a very significant effect. So the abuse of prescriptive authority and or prescriptions is something we ought to all be paying attention to, and hence my questions on this area.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. No further questions. Do I hear a motion? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill 12 from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Is there objection? Motion carries. And I think the next committee of referral will be finance.
Yeah.
So if we can take a brief at ease.
We'll pound your gavel, man.
Welcome back to order, and the next item on the agenda, House Bill 16, and Rita Delbridge from Senator Mike Hawker's office, I'm sorry, Representative Mike Hawker's office is here as well to present the bill, but we do have an honored guest to present it, if in fact he is online, and that's Representative Hawker. Representative
Hawker.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. I am online.
Good to hear from you.
Well, it is very good to be heard from.
Mike, would you like to present your legislation?
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I very much would appreciate the opportunity here. And for your record-keeping purposes, I am State Representative Mike Hawker, District 32. I sincerely appreciate the indulgence of the committee in allowing me to present this telephonic presentation of the bill. You know, and it really is also a great honor to be the first House bill heard in the Senate this legislative session, and I think that fact alone speaks to the importance with which all of us attach the Senior Benefits Payment Program. House Bill 16 extends the current Alaska Senior Benefits Payment Program to June 30th of the year 2015. I think, as everyone knows, the benefits program was established in 2007, and unless it is reauthorized by this specific legislative action, the program will sunset on June 30th, 2011. That is this coming June. This most recent December, December 2010, there were 10,093 elder Alaskans of low income that were benefiting from this program. The average age across the state of our recipients is 75 years old, and the oldest is 105 years old. The way the Senior Benefits Program works is it provides monthly cash assistance to state residents who are age 65 or older, whose household income does not exceed parameters based on the federal poverty guidelines for Alaska. The payment structure is tiered, so the payments can either be 125, 175, or $250 each month, depending upon the individual's income. The full $250 a month payment goes to individuals with incomes of 75% or less than the federal poverty guideline. And for an individual, that is only $10,000 a year. The $175 a month payment is to individuals whose income is between 75 and 100% of the federal poverty guideline. That's the area between $10,000 and $13,600. The smallest payment, the $125 a month, goes to individuals with incomes between 100 and 175% of the federal poverty guideline. That takes folks from the $16,000 or the $13,600 a year to the $23,800 a year. I want to emphasize that House Bill 16 does not change any of the benefits that are available under this program, does not change any of the program parameters. The program is somewhat self-adjusting, however, in that it is the federal poverty guidelines are annually revised by the United States government. The bill then simply extends our program for 4 years. The program itself, it costs a Treasury approximately $20 million a year, but we've also got a provision in statute that authorizes the Department of Health and Social Services in any year in which there is insufficient appropriation to meet the overall demands of the program, the department may reduce or eliminate the benefit available to recipients. The idea is it's a nimble clause, allowing the department to be nimble in making sure that the program reaches the most people in the most fair way. Ability to reduce the benefits, along with the sunset provision attached to the program, is really there to make sure that the program does not become viewed as an entitlement. We all recognize the state has a uncertain fiscal future, and we want to be certain that this program and the people that benefit from it do recognize that at the end of the day, we do have to look at our state's financial resources each year in authorizing or reauthorizing the program. However, I believe at this time, when we consider the state's current and immediately projected fiscal circumstances, the senior benefits payment program very much merits being extended for the 4 years as provided in this bill. Frankly, I think this is just good public policy for us, and I very much am looking forward to moving this bill through our legislative process on an expedited basis, as there are many seniors who see the sunset date coming, and it is a very good thing for us to put their minds at ease. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be delighted to answer any questions or help the committee in any way I possibly can.
Great. Thank you, Representative Hochran. You came through loud and clear. Not only your testimony, but the audio quality sounded great as well. Questions for Representative Hochran? Seeing none, we do have some folks that are – thank you, Representative. We do have some folks that have signed up to testify in the audience, and first to testify will be Marie Darlin, representing AARP. Or, I'm sorry, Ms. Delbert, did you want to say anything else? Okay, thanks. Marie Darlin, representing AARP.
My name is Marie Darlin, and I'm representing the AARP Capital City Task Force today. And you already have our letter of support, which should be in your files, so I won't repeat all of that. But I do want to comment on the fact that we want our retirees to be able to remain in Alaska. And as we know, the senior benefit helps many of them do that. They are a vital part of our communities, and we need them for all the reasons of everything that they contribute then to our communities. So we're merely asking for your support for this legislation.
Thank you for the brevity, Ms. Darlin. Questions for Ms. Darlin? Thank you, Marie.
Thank you.
Next to testify will be Denise Daniello, Alaska Commission on Aging.
Thank you, Senator Egan, and members of the committee. I'm going to be brief as well. I just want to echo what Marie has mentioned in terms of benefits that this program brings to the seniors who rely upon this program. The commission advocated in support of this legislation when it was first introduced in 2007 by Representative Hawker. We've seen its importance for seniors across the state. There's not a large number of seniors who need this program, thank goodness, but it provides assistance to about one in five seniors, people age 65 and older. And something that we've seen, too, among the senior population is that as a person ages and spends down their assets, their resources become even more limited. So these funds, this program becomes even more important to seniors in helping them to make ends meet, afford food, fuel, medicine, health care, you know, basic life necessities. So I thank you for your support, and hopefully that you'll move it on.
Thank you, Ms. Daniello. Questions? Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Off now, we have now Dixie Hood. Dixie, if you can hear us, we'd be more than happy to hear your testimony.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Okay. My name is Dixie Hood, and I am just representing myself as a citizen. I live at 9350 View Drive in Juneau, and I've lived in Alaska for 35 years. I'm 77 years old and single, and I'm contacting you to request an amendment to HB 16, the legislation extending the senior benefit program. I urge you to base eligibility on net income, not gross income. As a senior with very limited income, I struggle month to month to cover my living expenses. I cannot afford to retire. Though my practice as a marriage and family therapist has dropped off alarmingly in the last 3 years with the economic situation, sometimes I barely cover my office overhead. But I can't have a home office. It's not an option because insurance companies will not cover claims unless there is a separate business address. Mental health services are usually covered at only 50%, so I think people consider counseling a discretionary expenditure during this time of job and income uncertainty, even if it could be beneficial for them. My main source of income is my Social Security benefit and the rent of a room in my home. And I want to tell you a little bit about my specific personal situation. When I built my house in the woods in 1979, I created a self-contained efficiency apartment in a 9-by-12-foot downstairs bedroom. The tenant has a bathroom of their own and shares the laundry with me. There's a carport for parking. The apartment is furnished and has cooking and refrigerator appliances, bookshelves and television set, dishes and utensils for cooking and eating. And I tell you all this because it was my plan to have help with my mortgage payment, and it has served that purpose. Also has proven helpful with my income taxes. 42% of repair and maintenance costs on my house is deductible as a business expense. This was with the help of my tax preparer, as well as the utilities I provide for the tenant. And that has resulted in my net income being approximately $9,000. But it's been problematic because the benefits are based on gross income. And when the program first started, I was provided $125 a month, and that was very helpful. But as the economic situation worsened and my expenses piled up, I went through all of my step IRA accounts. I have absolutely no assets left except a car that is paid for and my house that isn't yet paid for. but I did go through all the hoops to accomplish a mortgage modification. It took 6 months of struggle with GMAC, but I finally accomplished that because my mortgage payment was more than the 31% that they based the affordable home ownership program on.
Dixie, if I can ask you to summarize, please.
Yes, I've sought census work, working at the election day at polls, and working on the playground at Montessori Preschool, and all of this with my advancing age and physical limitations. And I really think it would make a very big difference, not just for me, but probably many seniors who would be able to benefit, and it would make a huge difference in our covering living expenses to have gross income be the old way and net income be a substitute for that. And I had applied for heating assistance because I had a $6,000 balance in my fuel oil account with Taku Oil, and it's a miracle that they keep on delivering to me because I never can pay off much of the old overdue balance. But the heating assistance program, I scored 1.67 instead of 2.0, and when I asked for an explanation, they said that was a formula that was in the computer. They really didn't know, but that I should apply for public assistance and food stamps, and that would up my score. So I applied for public assistance and food stamps, and I was denied because my gross income was too high. And I think that all of these programs should be based on net income because it has totally not allowed me to have any of these resources. And so I really urge you to consider this as an amendment to HB 16.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hood. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for providing me with an opportunity to...
Questions for Ms. Hood? Seeing none, again, Dixie, thank you very much for testifying and taking the time. We do have people from the department to answer questions. If there are any questions from committee members, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I would appreciate hearing from Representative Hawker and or the folks in the department on why we got to didn't have net instead of gross.
I'm sorry, Rod, come on up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, in that I was instrumental in crafting the original legislation that brought forward this program, I can explain that. We were looking to establish a low-income criteria, and we were looking for a criteria that was objective and determinable and something that would be annually adjusted. We really did not want to throw out a program and have to be debating every year what we may or may not establish as the allowable poverty levels. That's why we landed on the Federal Poverty Guideline. And the regulations, the Federal Poverty Guideline regulations, I believe, do go to an individual's annual gross income. And again, the reason there is very simply is that using gross income avoids having to make judgmental determinations about the relevancy, acceptability, perhaps qualification of the discretionary expenditures that are involved between an individual's gross and net income. And while, you know, certainly a very touching story of an individual here who perceives themselves as in need of this assistance, it's very difficult to throw open the entire program to a net basis. I mean, you know, with all respect, there's a lot of folks with gross income that might qualify here, but they could very well be spending all of it on trips to Hawaii or alcohol. So again, we're really, the gross test is an objective and independent evaluation. And for the woman that testified, we have a myriad of public safety net programs available to help, the heating assistance program, permanent fund dividends, adult public assistance, food stamps, Medicaid, just to mention a few.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Further questions? Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Representative Hawker, I appreciate your perspective, but if indeed we just changed it so it was gross income and maintained the three different steps that you have, I think, in the bill, it would seem to me that wouldn't require annual adjustments, and that if it went based on their income tax returns, you know, many of the things you mentioned are not deductions. Help me out. What am I missing that you're thinking here?
Well, I guess I'm afraid I don't understand your question. Again, we use the Federal Poverty Guideline, which is a federal standard that is maintained by the federal government that keeps us, the legislature, from having to make these determinations, and that the Federal Poverty Guideline is, in fact, accepted across the state for almost all public assistance programs as the measure of poverty.
No, I understand that very clearly. And keeping the percentages that are in that guideline, what would be the problem of changing it from gross to net?
Well, net to gross. The Chair, Senator Dyson,
gross to net. Yeah.
I'm looking at, I guess, it's that same kind of confusing question to me, because we could very well have an individual whose gross income is $100,000. That individual spends that income lavishly, and has it, at the end of the year, they've got less than, say, the $23,000, $24,000 needed to qualify for the program. That's not the intent of the program, to subsidize someone's lavish lifestyle. Again, the gross makes a more objective determinant of poverty.
Yeah, certainly I understand that, but indeed the lavish lifestyle is largely not deductible on the federal income tax.
Through the Chair, Senator Dyson, I guess if you wish to propose such an amendment, we could certainly consider it, but again, I would argue that we've been very successful with this program. It was a long and serious debate held to achieve, to arrive at these federal poverty level guidelines. They are the sort of standard across our programs in the state of Alaska, and I think we're better off retaining them.
Yeah, and I certainly wouldn't propose it over your objections, and I think you did a great job in putting this in place. I just wanted to understand what you were thinking. Thank you.
And through the Chair, thank you, Senator Dyson.
Senator Dyson, and the department is at the table. Ron, would you like to add anything? And I'm sorry.
For the record, this is Ron Kerr, acting Director for the Division of Public Assistance. I could not say it more eloquently than Representative Hawker, frankly. Generally speaking, all public assistance programs have a gross income test. Net income is typically considered income after allowable deductions. So some of the things that I heard testimony for would not count as a deduction in calculating net income even. But I would agree also with the representative. How could I possibly be drawing a blank? Because I was thinking we should hire that man. Representative Hawker, excuse me.
You'll be pleased to hear that.
I would hope so, but we do have a wonderful division. I think that the gross test is a very equitable way of making that initial determinant of eligibility.
Great, thank you. Questions for the department? And thank you very much for coming forward. Mr. Senator Dyson, are you going to, do I hear a motion? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm a co-sponsor on this bill. It's a good bill, and it's got a long history, as was mentioned, and I think it's doing exactly what we had hoped and intended when we passed it 4 years ago. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we move House Bill 16 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease. Motion carries. And we'll now hear a presentation from Denali Family Services, A Little Steps Preschool. Dr. Yvonne Chase
will
be the presenter.
Thank you. Yvonne, Mr.
Welcome
Chair,
to Juneau.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am here today with the director of our preschool, Kyle Gardner, and we appreciate your time. We want to tell you about a unique program. And I won't spend time on the research because I think you have heard it from many other places, but there's certainly been research through Department of Education and Early Development as well as Health and Social Services about the need to focus on pre-kindergarten and some of the issues that children face in those years, which if not addressed are much worse, much more serious for them, but also much more costly for any system as they grow older. We are located in both Anchorage and the Matsu Valley and serve that area with wraparound services. However, our preschool at this point is limited to Anchorage. We have, and Kyle will describe it a little bit more, but we have a preschool that I think has the only model in the state of this kind. We serve both typically developing children as well as children who have special emotional and behavioral needs. Children who, many of whom have been diagnosed as severely emotionally disturbed. And we actually had one little kiddo who had been expelled from 11 childcare facilities. If you can imagine at that age, having that history of being expelled, that we've been able to work with very successfully at this preschool. We're also one of six demonstration projects in the country in a model that I will have Kyle describe. We have a couple of reasons for coming in and talking to you about the program. We are hoping to have a little bit of assistance, financial assistance, not in operations, but we are hoping to have some permanency both in Anchorage as well as in the Valley, where we have, at Anchorage we have a waiting list of over 70 children, and in the Valley we have a waiting list, but no program in operation yet. And so my hope in these economic times is that we can utilize the buildings that may be there and look to also assist the economy in those areas by doing some kind of a lease purchase so that we can have permanency. Because some of the requirements that we fall under for childcare facilities are fairly lengthy and require some special accommodations. And so we are looking in both of those areas to perhaps have some, excuse me, some assistance with a down payment so that we can achieve that kind of permanency in those communities. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kyle Gardner, who is our director of preschool and who's very enthusiastic. And we have a short power presentation to show you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I would like to start talking about Little Steps Preschool, and at any point along the way, if there's any topics I'm talking about, feel free to stop me and intervene with any questions as you need. This is a, as it says, a guided tour of Little Steps Preschool, so we will just get started. What we are, Little Steps is a therapeutically inclusive preschool, and we are, as Yvonne mentioned, the only model that operates on this in the state of Alaska, having both typically developing children and those who have severely emotionally disturbed diagnoses in the same classroom so that they can help work with one another and, you know, learn from each other in the classroom setting to help with some internal problem-solving skills that they are able to pick up through that. And as she also touched on, she kind of covered all of my first slide here, but we are one of the first six demonstration sites in the country, and that is in collaboration through the state of Alaska, a grant we received along with the Center of Social and Emotional Foundations of Early Learning and the Technical Assistance Center on Social Emotional Interventions. And so this curriculum is a social-emotional-based curriculum that we utilize to help with feeling identification, some problem-solving abilities, and it's been, again, proven to be very effective in the beginnings of education, especially with our clientele having, you know, some of those difficult behaviors they're working with. But then with our unique clientele, we also maintain a very high staffing ratio of very highly trained staff in the classrooms, as well as having a full-time clinician on site who can run some of our group therapy time, some individual therapy, some of the other needs of those young kiddos to help support them within our center to, again, have that structure and that support that they need to continue growing and learning in that direction. Again, the early years are very much the critical years. We have a licensed capacity of 60. Right now we are running at full capacity of just over 50 children enrolled in our program. And so we also, I checked this morning, we have a wait list that is 72 children in Anchorage right now, as well as we get anywhere between 2 to 10 calls a day of people who have heard of us and are very much interested in our services. But when they hear that it'll be a year or longer until they can get in, they just can't. They can't wait that long, and so then they move on to the next center. And so we could actually have a wait list that would be far higher than that if we had everyone who called was on our wait list. And again, we have a wait list in the Valley when we, as Little Steps, are not out in that physical location. Just due to some of the word of mouth about how good our services are in town, how much our outcomes are positively, you know, we're changing our our overall structure within with this new grant, and our outcomes are becoming very much more positive. We're getting a lot of referrals from other professionals as well as family members, other parents, people who have heard through many different venues how good Little Steps is and want to get into Little Steps. And right now it is our capacity of size that is our limiting factor. This here slide, it highlights the United Way hung some bamboo blinds for our children, which I guess that shows we are right now located on Fifth Avenue, about that sidewalk distance from a very busy street as well as very busy walkways. And so that gave us a little bit of privacy, but it also identifies the collaboration within our community that Little Steps is part of. We not only utilize United Way for their Day of Caring, but within the early childhood field, we work with THRED, which works as a referral and resource agency for child care agencies. They do assessments and evaluations of us and train our staff, as well as we work with Stone Soup Group on some parenting groups that we run internally. And we also have, for the kids' sake, we have the police department and the fire department come down during the summer. We have the zoo comes in to our services, brings an animal with. We also have Lowe's come in and work on building shelves and birdhouses and a lot of very enriching activities that we have very good working relationships with different agencies throughout Anchorage that come to us and provide some pretty cool services for our children. And so what makes Little Steps so special? It is we have 12 amazing teachers. We have a wonderful cook who gives us 3 meals a day. We have an administrative assistant who keeps up on all of the wonderful paperwork that comes along with running a community-based mental health child care center. We have our all-knowing clinician, as well as we have weekly consultations with Dr. Mike, who is a doctor of psychology who comes in and does staffing with us. So if we have a kiddo who's having some tough times, we can get some time with Dr. Mike, and he'll just listen to us. He's been in and out of the center enough to kind of know what's going on, and he will sort of summarize what's going on, give us a different view of things, and really help with some of those, you know, difficult times and some of those more advanced behavior patterns that maybe our teachers don't necessarily know exactly what to do with. And so it's a very good layer of support. But really what makes us special is having high-quality staff who care about kids, who are willing to come in the door every day and bring their A-game to the table, as well as the administrative support that Yvonne provides to Little Steps to be able to have the time to structure our classrooms, to plan together, to stay on top of our social-emotional curriculum that is very encompassing within our walls. And so I think those also add into the physical number of the staff. As far as Little Steps, we do have 4 classrooms right now in Anchorage. We serve children ages 1 year all the way until they go to kindergarten. So we have a 1 to 2-year-old classroom, a 2 to 3-year-old classroom, and then we have 2 3 to 5-year-old classrooms. And so within each of those classrooms, there's obviously very different things that go on throughout the day. But the core, again, of our strength is our structure, both in the physical layout of the classroom, having very defined centers with defined activities and defined expectations, but also the day itself is structured in the activities that go on as far as transitioning from this to the next activity, and the children get prompted on what is coming up, which really helps being proactive in that social-emotional component of our program. So we'll start right in with the 1 and 2-year-old classroom. These are the earliest learners we have. If you look at the pictures behind you up there, you will see it is very much a hands-on learning experience within that classroom. And say the next biggest challenge is to keep it a mouths-off learning experience, because that is still very much a learning tool for the kiddos of that age, is to put everything in their mouth. And so that is very much one of the interesting battles that we fight in that classroom. We don't, social-emotional component isn't very much existent in this room. It's the beginning of colors and letters and some of those early pieces. But again, it builds as they move into the 2 to 3 year old classroom, whereas their intellectual ability grows, we can add more academic components and we can begin some of that social emotional pieces as far as identifying some feelings, saying, you know, look at the picture of this face. What does that person look like? They look angry. And so we're beginning some of those social emotional pieces that then can go along with academics. And as we move up to the next classroom, the 3 to 5 year olds, we very much have a strong, strong social emotional component. We have obviously academics that are throughout the day. We have different activity times and learning centers. But we also have, as you guys see before you, there are some scripted stories. They each have different themes and talk about kind of being a super friend, what it looks like to be responsible. And so on these levels, we are past, we're learning that, you know, we know what happy is and we know what angry is. But now we're starting, what can you do with that? When you're angry, you can stomp your feet. You don't need to throw your toy and yell and run around the room. And so we are beginning, we don't teach these in the moment. We are pre-teaching so that when these moments come up, the children already have these resources internally to then bank to and start working on that internal problem-solving abilities as compared to a teacher intervention at any given time. And so that is, again, the strength of that program. As far as evidence-based practice, again, with the grant that we received that is throughout the state of Alaska and the state of Minnesota is the other state that is participating in this. It is considered to be the strongest social-emotional curriculum that you can work with at the early education age, as well as our academic curriculum we work with is creative curriculum, which it is also considered the best practice in the early childhood field. So we are utilizing both academic and social-emotionally what is the best practice in the field. And right now, what's going on in the communities is that we need, as Yvonne mentioned, more space in the valley as well as some more space in Anchorage. Right now, our limiting factor isn't our ability to perform quality work or to have a, you know, a very positive environment for these kiddos. We can see that the teachers can do that. We have very good groundwork laid. Now we need to take that next step due to the need within our community of 70-plus children on our wait list to expand our services to help get them in and begin that proactive pre-teaching so that we don't end up needing more services later in those years.
And I might just say there that we've, I'm a part of the behavioral health integration team of providers in the Valley, and the rest of the providers have decided that they do not want to do a preschool, that they'd be happy to have us try to do that piece because they have other special populations that they're working with and can certainly use that referral.
And yeah, program expectations. Again, we have our social emotional expectations within our program of the four we use of be safe, be responsible, be respectful, and be a team player. And those you will see resounded throughout not only the teaching, but the interactions of the teachers with our children. And so we've always been a proactive center. Something before that might have said, you know, use your walking feet inside. We'll now have that added expectation to give it meaning of make sure we're being safe and using your walking feet inside.
But I just was reminded, thank you, that I'm watching the screen. That's why I'm not watching, but I am actually watching your presentation.
Okay.
I'm sitting here looking.
Good, good. And yeah, really, I mean, as it says, come visit us sometime. We have different people. And that's another piece that is very exciting with the new expansion into this national demonstration site and our more strengthened curriculums is we are becoming a teaching site within Anchorage. I've been approached by other directors who are bringing their teachers into our, you know, into our classrooms to study our structure, to study our interactions, to learn from us and take it back to their center. So we're not only trying to expand the quantity and quality of our own services, but we are looking to help scaffold those high-quality services throughout the early childhood field in Anchorage and Wasilla.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How prevalent is autism spectrum disorders among your population of children?
It is rising as it is in the general population, and so with our clientele being younger, at times it is hard to diagnose at that young of an age, but we do find it coming into our program more frequently than we did a few years ago. But the kind of the structured base of our program does allow for us to work more successfully in both of those fields because, you know, you get the developmental delay field and the mental health field, and they are very similar, but you have some core differences in kind of how you interact. And the strength of our program is it has the structure that can have the success for a, you know, FASD or autism spectrum type diagnoses, but it also has that component to work proactively on those behaviors as far as with some children with their mental health diagnoses.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that presentation. You answered part of my question because one of the areas that we're learning more about is the FASD kids. And are you seeing an increase in those type of kids? I guess most of your kids are just coming from the Anchorage area, right? Mm-hmm. You don't really get that many from the rural areas yet. So.
Not in my service, you know, not within the preschool. Again, we work with children up to ages 21 at Denali Family Services, and so there's definitely more prevalency throughout the, you know, the upper years of that.
There are three coming in from the valley, right?
Oh, for children? Yeah.
Right. We also have three parents from the valley. Since we don't have a program in operation out there yet, we're bringing their children into Anchorage on a daily basis.
Hmm. Do they work in Anchorage, or are they just?
Two of them do, I believe.
Okay.
Yes.
And then, so you're requesting a legislative grant for $400,000?
Correct.
And that's to get a bigger place?
It's to get a bigger place in Anchorage. We did not include on there, because we hadn't located a building in the valley, but we have since located a building in the valley that we are hoping to be able to at least have a lease purchase so that we can begin to offer those same services there as well, so the parents don't have to make that trip in.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Dyson.
I was just wondering if the chair realized it was Matsu Valley, not Mendenhall, that she was talking about.
We have our own issues. Thank you, Senator. Further questions from the committee? Ms. Chase and Mr. Gardner, we do appreciate your presentation and for taking the time.
Thank you for hearing us.
Out of your schedule as well to make the presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for attending. And I think that concludes the presentation for today. Thank you very much, Ms. Hodge. And thank you, committee members, for putting up with me. And again, Senator Davis apologizes for not being able to be in attendance, but she was very busy at another meeting, so I got to try my first meeting.
Thank
so.
You for your time.
Anyway, meeting is adjourned at 2:31. Meeting is adjourned.